The headlines this hour. Human Rights Watch accuses Israel of pursuing policies of apartheid and persecution against Palestinians that amount to crimes against humanity. Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal meet in Vienna for a new round of talks on reviving the international accord. And India's daily coronavirus infections retreat from record levels but stay well above the 300,000 mark for a sixth straight day. Thanks for joining us. A prominent international rights group says that Israel's persecution of Palestinians amounts to crimes against humanity and crimes of apartheid. Human Rights Watch says examples of Israel's apartheid policies are its restrictions on Palestinians' movement and the seizure of their land for illegal settlements. The rights group has called on the International Criminal Court to investigate and prosecute Israeli officials over persecution of Palestinians. Several weeks ago, the court said that it would investigate war crimes against the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Mona Kandil in the occupied West Bank gives us more details on the latest report by Human Rights Watch.
They are accusing the Israeli authorities that they are allowing the Jewish settlers over Palestinians across the occupied territories. We are speaking about the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and even they are speaking about the besieged Gaza Strip. The aim is combined with the systematic oppression of the Palestinians and inhumane acts committed against them, which Human Rights Watch says taken together constitute the crime of apartheid. Let's elaborate what's the meaning of apartheid according to the international law. It's deemed as a crime against humanity by the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court. The definition has many elements, mainly maintaining a group of people, domination by one racial group over another. So then, according to all the agreements, Palestinians must get these lands in order to establish their future Palestinian state. However, the Israeli authorities had brought those Jewish settlers to the mountains of the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. Al-Quds, they continue to attack Palestinians, assault them, seize their lands, ruin their properties. Every day, the Israeli authorities approve numerous laws against the law in order to protect and defend the Israeli settlers over the Palestinians while committing more crimes against the Palestinian people.
The chief commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has warned that the Islamic Republic will respond strongly to any act of mischief by Israel. Major General Hossein Salami made the remarks in an interview with Lebanon's Arabic-language Al-Mayadeen television news network. Salami added that the acts of mischief by the Israeli regime in the region would expose it to real threats in the future. The top commander warned that the evil acts of the regime will backfire and draw it closer to collapse. Political commentator Firas Al-Najim says the international community is silent about the Israeli regime's atrocities and human rights violations.
The Zionist regime is backed up and supported and armed by, you know, all kind of governments in the world and regimes. And they have a green light to do whatever they want and to hit what they want. And nobody is ever penalizing them and holding them accountable. Right. We see United Nations is silent about the Israeli atrocities, their human rights violations, their, you know, their breaches of airspace in Lebanon, in Syria, even in Iraq. I mean, these people, they don't have any respect for any law, and they think that they can get away with it. We see clearly the IRGC Quds Force commander, when they killed Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, we see when he came out that time and he gave a statement and a declaration, and he had the flags of all the resistance groups, Hamas, Ansar Allah in Yemen. So this obviously was coordinated with all these resistance groups. So now this alliance is very well-equipped, very strongly working together, and the Zionist regime knows this, and they are surrounded by resistance, and not normal resistance. We're talking about resistance that has been resisting for years and years and helped liberate. Like, for instance, Hezbollah, they liberated Lebanon from the Israeli occupation and from any other intrusions or invasions.
Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal are set to resume negotiations in Vienna to revive the troubled accord. Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi is leading Iran's delegation in discussions with France, Germany, Britain, Russia, and China. The diplomatic effort began in early April and is being coordinated by the European Union. All sides have described as constructive their previous meetings. The talks are aimed at making practical arrangements required for the U.S. to return to the nuclear deal. Iran wants all sanctions imposed by the U.S. after its 2018 withdrawal to be removed at once. Araghchi has warned that Iran will walk out of the talks if it finds them long drawn out. Homo Leslie is a correspondent joining us from Vienna. So I'm tempted to ask you all kinds of questions, but I'm going to revert only to ask what you have to say, because there could be statements that are being misconstrued or misrepresented or just represented in other ways because of the sensitivity of the talk. So Homa, over to you.
Yes, Kaveh, thank you. So as you say, we're going to have another joint commission session here in Vienna in a matter of hours. It's been scheduled for around 3 p.m. Vienna time, so some 5 hours from now. But already we saw Iran's lead delegate, Abbas Araghchi, this morning entering the venue of the talks, Grand Hotel, and also the EU representative, Enrica Mora, also entering the Grand Hotel. So ahead of the Joint Commission meeting, as always, we do have various bilateral, trilateral, different kinds of meetings taking place between the sides. The aim, of course, of the Joint Commission session is for the expert groups and for the political directors to review the work that's been done up until this stage and to decide what still needs to be done, if they should or should not continue the talks and how long it's going to take. That's also a major question. We had last week the Russian envoy to the talks, for instance, saying that he believes the talks could, if the political will exists, the talks could end by the end of May. And that's when a temporary deal between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency, allowing for access to Iran and verification, despite the law that was passed by the Iranian parliament, expires. So that is seen as one deadline, although Iran and the other negotiators have also said time and again that they're not putting any deadlines for themselves officially, and that they believe that they will continue the talks as long as it takes, because the issues that are being discussed need detailed technical discussions. But as Iran has pointed out time and again, if they come to a conclusion that the other side is basically prolonging these negotiations or coming up with demands beyond the Iran's JCPOA commitments, then Tehran will stop these talks. But up until now, it looks like they see the need for these negotiations to continue. But what are the important questions? What sanctions is the U.S. going to agree to lift? That's the basic issue. It looks like the sides have been drafting, coming up with lists. The two working groups working on the sanctions that need to be lifted, Iran on the measures that it needs to take to come back to full compliance, and now a third working group introduced to come up with issues related to sequencing. This is something that hasn't been discussed in detail before, but is expected to be discussed from this stage on. What the U.S. means by sequencing, from the sources that we've heard in media from various U.S. State Department officials, is that they want mutual compliance, or compliance for compliance, similar to what Iran has rejected as a step-by-step approach. Iran has been saying that it is not changing its position, that it will only come back to full compliance after the U.S. has removed all the sanctions and after Iran has verified the removal. But there are questions, for instance, about the time it will take for Iran to do that verification. One report was saying, quoting senior U.S. officials, that they will not agree to a long-term verification process. Some other reports to sources from Iran saying that verification, for instance, of sanctions on the oil sector could take at least 3 months, which is not very viable. So a lot of questions still remain unanswered. Mr. Araghchi, upon his return to Iran, in an address in a meeting with parliamentarians, did make some comments about the U.S. Willing to lift sanctions that are affecting Iran's oil sales, also on the area of banking and insurance. But we have to see what this will mean, because some sources have been saying, is the U.S. going to remove these sanctions completely, or is this just about suspension of sanctions? Is this about extending waivers? So how much can Iran practically benefit? Because the U.S. has made it clear that it is still not considering lifting all of the sanctions that were imposed under the Trump administration. And a lot of those sanctions will affect the practical implementation of the JCPOA, because they have been imposed under terrorism labels, but they are affecting Iran's central banks. They are affecting Iran's various industries. So if the U.S. doesn't agree to lift those sanctions, on the ground, Iran would not be able to benefit economically. So we'll see if these very serious issues can actually be resolved in the coming days. We're expecting Mr. Araghchi to talk to us after the Joint Commission meeting. Maybe he'll shed some more light on the issues that are being focused on or can or cannot be resolved.
Very well. I just went down my checklist. I think you covered anything that I wanted to ask you, so we appreciate that. Thank you. Homolesky there, and hopefully we'll be looking forward to, as you said, your interview with Araghchi and get a clear idea about how talks are progressing or not. Homolesky there. Many thanks. India's new daily COVID cases have stayed above 300,000 for the sixth day in a row. The country recorded over 323,000 new cases in the past 24 hours. That was below a Monday worldwide peak of over 352,000. India's total COVID cases now top 17.6 million, the second largest in the world. Its total deaths are nearly 200,000. The virus surge in India has caused the shortage of beds and oxygen supplies that has forced hospitals to turn away patients. The government has called on armed forces to help tackle the crisis. Several countries have already pledged to send medical aid to the country. Manavar Zaman says the situation is very bleak in India, and the COVID-19 crisis there is likely to deepen in the coming weeks.
So the situation is very bleak. Now the international support is pouring in for the country. Let's wait and watch what happens. There are so many countries that are supplying oxygen cylinders and more medical equipments. But somehow it looks like it is going to be even worse with the coming few weeks, because if we talk about the pandemic, there are predictions that by the end of the April or with the starting of first week of May, India might see 5,000 deaths every day and more than 300,000 cases, or perhaps many reports suggest that India might register as many as 500,000 cases by the mid of the May. So the country is desperately battling with an invisible victim. I'm sorry, the invisible enemy, which is the COVID-19.
America remains one of the hotspots of the coronavirus pandemic, with Brazil being the worst hit nation in the region. Brazil has registered over 1,100 new COVID deaths and over 28,600 additional cases. Figures push the country's death toll to nearly 400,000 out of 14.3 million confirmed cases. Meanwhile, Mexico has reported over 1,100 new cases and 116 more deaths. This brings its total caseload to over 2.3 million, while fatalities are hovering around 215,000. Peru has also registered 433 deaths in a single day, bringing the tally to almost 60,000. The Andean nation, with some 33 million population, has reported over 1.7 million cases so far. Family lawyers for African-American man Andrew Brown Jr., who was fatally shot by police in the state of North Carolina, say that he was, quote, executed. Attorneys who gained access to a small portion of footage captured by the police body cameras said that the officers were shooting and at the same time asking the man to show his hands. The incident took place last Wednesday in Elizabeth City. The police claimed the shooting happened as Brown was trying to flee while the officers were going to serve him an arrest warrant for drug-related charges. The shooting came amid growing anger and protests across the U.S. over the killing of African Americans at the hands of law enforcement officers. Colin Campbell says attorneys believe that there is some obfuscation about the African-American Andrew Brown Jr. case, as he was shot in the back of his head.
From indications, it appears that Brown was shot in the back of his head, and attorneys say that his hands were still on the steering wheel when he was shot. So this could indicate that the person was trying to comply while he was being shot. It could show that he was trying to drive away when he was shot. There's still a lot that needs to be investigated, but it has shown, at least from what attorneys are saying, that this was not a very clean type of, obviously not a clean arrest, but not a clean shooting either. It was not a very clear case, and it looks like there was some obfuscation there and some cause for concern, as the bullet appears to be in the back of Brown's head, not in the front, where he would be more of a threat to police. So I think that's why a lot of people want to see this video and why it's being heavily scrutinized.
The Turkish president slams Washington's declaration that the 1915 massacres of Armenians constituted genocide, and calls on the U.S. president to reverse, quote, wrong step on the declaration.
In a message published on April 24th, the president of the United States of America, Joe Biden, used words that were baseless, unfair, and contrary to reality regarding the painful events that happened in our region more than a century ago. We now need to put aside the issues that poison the relations between the two countries and look at what steps we can take from now on. Otherwise, we will have no choice but to do what is required by the level our ties have fallen to on April 24th.
In his first comment since Biden's statement, Erdogan said that the move was upsetting and diminished bilateral ties. The Turkish president noted that he expected to discuss all disputes with Biden at a NATO summit in June, but warned that ties would deteriorate further unless the allies can compartmentalize issues. Biden's declaration on Saturday has infuriated Turkey, which says the announcement has opened a, quote, deep wound in relations. And that is for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Imam Khomeini was a religious scholar and a true worshipper and servant of God. If you remember the previous episode, it was said that Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was very hateful of doing mustahab or recommended acts, although they're not religiously obligatory. You also heard that he was very careful not to do makruh or disapproved acts, the acts that are not haram or forbidden but have been emphasized to refrain from. Today we are going to continue the discussion. Nafile in Arabic means additional. According to the Islamic jurisprudence, it means the daily prayers that are not obligatory and just recommended. These prayers have a lot of reward. There are 34 rak'at of recommended prayers, which are performed with daily ritual obligatory ones. But on Friday, 4 rak'at are added to this number. These prayers are highly emphasized to recite as God will give ample rewards for them. However, the midnight prayer is the most important recommended prayer and has a lot of effects in both material and spiritual aspects of human life. According to the statements of the Prophet and the infallible Imams, recommended prayers somehow compensate for the shortcomings of obligatory ones. Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, says in this regard, "Indeed, we have been ordered to perform recommended prayers in order to compensate for the defects of obligatory prayers." Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, also says, "God said, 'Indeed, my servant seeks proximity to me by recommended prayer and deeds, and once I like him, I will be his ear that he hears with it, his eye that sees with it, and his tongue that speaks with it.'" Hujjat al-Islam Rasuli Mahallati said, "As far as I remember and I have heard from the relatives and companions of Imam Khomeini, he would not give up performing recommended prayers as much as he could." Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini didn't give up performing recommended prayers even when the security forces of the Pahlavi regime, Savak, intruded into his house. Late Ayatollah Tawassuli also mentioned an interesting memory. In the evening of the day in which the tragedy of Faizia school happened, we were at the Imam's home. We heard that the seminary students had been beaten and the regime forces intended to come there. Late Sayyid Muhammad Sadiq stood up and closed the door of the house. But Imam Khomeini immediately stood up and opened the door, saying, "Shall I close the door of my house while they are beating my children?" Then he stood up for prayer and, like other nights, performed midnight prayer while every moment his house would likely be attacked. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini would not leave performing of recommended prayers even at the times that he was exhausted. Late Ayatollah Bani Fazil related a memory on this. In the first days after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Qom, Imam Khomeini had public meetings from 8:30 a.m. till midday, during which he would deliver detailed speeches. So he had to go upstairs to the roof several times. One day, a few minutes before noon, the Imam's face was very tired as he was going into the room. I said to myself that this time he would have a rest, but when I followed him, I saw him performing recommended prayer of midday obligatory prayer. Imam Khomeini would observe little points even in recommended prayers. For instance, he would not forget saying, "A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim," which means, "I seek refuge with God from the outcast Satan." Imam's companions also say that he used to recite Surah Tawhid in both his obligatory and recommended prayers, although it can be dropped in recommended ones. Imam Khomeini would not give up performing of recommended prayers even in hot summer. Ayatollah Qadiri says, "In the blessed month of Ramadan, when the Imam would come to the school of late Ayatollah Borujerdi in Najaf for midday and afternoon prayers, he used to first perform the 8 rak'at recommended prayers of midday prayer and then perform the midday prayer itself. This was not an easy job for a fasting person of that age and in such a hot weather. Even the youth would fail to do it, but the Imam was so serious in worships." Hujjat al-Islam Sayyid Mujtaba Rudbari relates a memory. "In such an old age and during the hot days of Ramadan in Najaf, Imam Khomeini would observe the recommended prayers of Maghrib or Dusk and Isha, that is 9 obligatory prayers, whereas we as young people were expecting to finish prayer to go to iftar for breaking the fast."
The debate.
When it comes to the U.S. and international troop pullout from Afghanistan, all is not as it sounds. In the latest, the Pentagon has deployed B-52 bombers to West Asia and to what it calls the support of the withdrawal of U.S. troops from the country. That is, if the troops actually withdraw. And even if they eventually do, reports have surfaced that the U.S. will leave over 18,000 military and private contractors and special forces in that country, putting the whole notion of a troop pullout into question. To discuss this a little bit further, first let's cross on over to Kabul and talk to our correspondent Amin Alami, who joins us. I mean, at this point, we know what the latest is in terms of the U.S. Having these B-52 bombers on standby. Tell us more about the positioning of the U.S. and whether there's actually any movement when it comes to a troop pullout from that country, along with the coalition forces.
Of course, the top U.S. military commander in Afghanistan just declared that the preparations has begun for the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan, and that American troops are going to hand over all military bases and military equipment to the Afghan security and defense forces in order to help them to fight against terrorist groups, mainly the Taliban, after the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan. But there are doubts also here in Afghanistan about the real pullout of American forces in Afghanistan. I mean that top U.S. military and political officials have so far emphasized that they will not leave Afghanistan alone and they will support this country. It means that the Washington will continue to follow its own interests in Afghanistan via, as you mentioned, using private contractors in order to continue its military presence in Afghanistan beyond the withdrawal of military forces from Afghanistan by September this year. In the meantime, another important fact is that the Afghan government says that the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan will not negatively affect the situation, the security situation in Afghanistan, because Afghanistan's national armed troops are now enough capable to not only confront terrorist groups, but also to strongly pound their positions across this country. For instance, I can briefly point out to the recent remarks of Afghanistan's Defense Minister General Yassin Zia, who said that Afghan military forces, mainly Afghan Air Force, are conducting heavy military operations across Afghanistan, mainly in southern parts of this country and, of course, in northern provinces of Balkh and Faryab to eliminate the terrorist groups, including Taliban and Daesh. But what remains as a big question is that will the ongoing political efforts lead Afghanistan and the war-weary nation here to a lasting peace? Only, I think, the time will answer such a question.
Okay, thank you for that. We appreciate it. That's a correspondent there, Amin Alami, talking to us from Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Okay, let's bring in co-founder of Code Pink Media, Benjamin, from Washington, D.C., one of our guests, and also from the Answer Coalition. Richard Becker joins us from San Francisco. Welcome to you both, Media Benjamin. First to you, the U.S. and the coalition forces, the announcement has been made. Do you think that they are sincere when they say there will be a troop pullout from Afghanistan?
There are all of these plans to keep U.S. Proxy war going in a way in terms of the mercenaries who are there, paramilitary units, CIA operatives, and the ability to continue to conduct airstrikes on the part of the Afghan government, which is a government that does not have a lot of popular support. So I also think it's important to recognize that according to the agreement that was worked out over a long period of time between the Trump administration and the Taliban, U.S. troops were supposed to have left by May 1st. Now, Joe Biden, as he was campaigning, knew about that agreement. He had plenty of time to make that decision early on when he came in, and instead decided to push the date back to September 11th. And while in the U.S., that doesn't seem like a big problem, on the ground in Afghanistan, I think it is, because the April 24th was the date that was going to be a next round of peace talks, and the Taliban pulled out of that because the U.S. had violated the agreement for May 1st. So I think there are, as your person on the ground just said, it remains to be seen how much the U.S. is going to go through with its call to not only pull out the troops, but to stop its involvement in the Afghan war in general.
Richard Becker, you have many who are supporting this, and at the same time, you have many who are not. It's kind of reminiscent of the fact when Donald Trump announced his troop pullout from Syria, many opposition towards that, and many who actually supported it. However, in this case, you're having the opposition in its variety, saying that it fears it could create a dangerous power vacuum in the region. Which camp are you in?
Well, I think that the U.S. troops need to withdraw, and the mercenaries need to withdraw as well, the contractors. The problems of Afghanistan can only really be resolved by the Afghan people themselves. And the U.S. has really been in Afghanistan since intervening in 1979, before the Soviet intervention, which was 20 years later, was revealed. There's a great deal that we do not know about the extent of U.S. forces there. I think that if we know from earlier wars, Vietnam War, the wars in Central America, that there were far, far more U.S. forces in the country and in different forms, taking different forms, and with mercenary units as well, than was led on to the public in the United States. The public in the United States does not know what the role, to a very large degree, does not know what the real role of the United States was in destabilizing Afghanistan in ways that have made it very, very difficult to overcome. This is the result of the reckless, imperialist, interventionist policies and the havoc that they wreak on, that those interventions wreak on countries. But, you know, to answer your question once again, only the Afghan people can determine the future of Afghanistan. The occupation needs to end.
Okay, well, Media Benjamin, you know, we need to discuss this because we just need to, since the U.S. opted to stay in that country for, 20 years, the longest war. Let me get your reaction from one quote that I picked from a 20-year-old veteran of the U.S. Air Force, who, by the way, is against the troop pullout. She said, "We spent almost 20 years in that country, and we have nothing to show for it. It was not a well-thought-out invasion. There was no plan to actually defeat the Taliban terrorists who go into hiding, and then they bide their time and then come back out to fight again." What do you think about what this particular veteran has said?
Well, I'd say it's even worse than that. I mean, we do have something to show for it, and that is the death of countless Afghans and the displacement of so many Afghan citizens, the death of over 2,400 U.S. troops, and the trillions of dollars that could have been spent in really helping poor countries like Afghanistan or improving the lives of people in the United States. So it's not that it's devastating the violence that we perpetrated against the Afghan people, and it's devastating for soldiers and their families. Not only did we lose over 2,400, but tens of thousands were maimed and hurt psychologically in these wars and will live forever with those consequences. So I think that we should recognize that the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan has been an absolute disaster, despite the fact that Biden wants to put a spin on it, that we accomplished our mission, which he says was to bring to justice those who attacked us on 9/11 and to make sure that Afghanistan was not a haven for al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Well, the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan was supposed to bring a stable Afghan government, which it didn't do. Look at the opium production that is going on in Afghanistan today, the fact that the Taliban control over half of the territory. I mean, it has been just an overall abysmal failure.
You know, it's hard, Richard Becker. It sounds like a broken record, but then there's so many ways that different organizations, different people, different officials, common people, et cetera, who have questioned where the U.S. went wrong and what did it really achieve. One of the particular instances comes back to an investigative journalistic work that was done, which I'm sure that you've heard of it, and that was from the Washington Post, where it was said that even at some point military officials were making up their successes, and that was just to appease the public, but they knew that they had no idea what they were doing in Afghanistan. It just boggles the mind, is what I'm trying to say, as to what went wrong there. or was that a system by design because there were some gains that were being made that we're not aware of? Is that the case?
Well, there's no question. I don't think there can be any question that when these kind of interventions take place, these really wars against other people, you know, we just have to remember the Vietnam War and that the big scandal when Daniel Ellsberg, who had been on the side of the government and working for Rand Institute, when he turned against the war and released the Pentagon Papers, you know, they tried to try him for treason, the same way that they tried Chelsea Manning and might have tried Julian Assange and so forth, because they revealed the reality that these kind of imperialist interventions, wars, take place against peoples that are not understood at all by those who are intervening and who are leading those interventions. And so they construct policies which inevitably fail, except in causing, as Medea said, great widespread death and destruction in those countries. This happens over and over and over again. You can see in Iraq that U.S. claimed that they had constructed a new national army for Iraq and were going to be able to leave. That army collapsed. I don't think the Afghan military is doing much better. And it's not a consequence of what's going on in those countries. It's that foreign occupiers cannot do that. They cannot really construct armies that are national armies because they are really armies that were constructed by, and are really led by foreign interests, in this case, Washington above all. And so it turns into one disaster after another. And it brings about a situation like today. The Taliban is a very reactionary organization. It endangers the rights of women and the public in general. But the reality is that none of this protracting the war and the policies that go on with it that is not going to lead to anything but more disaster.
Yeah, it's a. What I find very interesting is, Media Benjamin, that both you and our guest there, Richard Becker, mentioned the word contractors that are going to remain in that country. Well, this was a stunner, and the way that both of you mentioned contractors, in a sense, it was skimming over it, even though you made your point clear. But the stunner was when the news came out after the announcement that Biden isn't ending the Afghanistan war. He's actually privatizing it, special forces, Pentagon contractors, intelligence operatives, to remain 18,000 of them. And that doesn't sound like a true pullout. Is that figure something that shocks you? And is this something that shocks you when you hear about how many may remain in that country? According to this report, about 18,000 of them.
Yes, I think the issue is that we don't know, that there is no transparency. There used to be some more transparency, for example, about how many sorties the U.S. was carrying out. It used to be public information. But that was stopped during the Trump time, and it's continued under Biden. So we don't even know what the continuation of U.S. airstrikes are. And certainly we are never told the truth about how many contractors, how many CIA operatives, how many special forces. This is not public information. So I think the public in the U.S. is quite happy with the idea that the U.S. troops are leaving, but very few people have probably even read those reports that say, there's a little caveat in this, that the U.S. troops leaving does not mean an end to the U.S. engagement. But I think there will continue to be pressure on the Biden administration to stop its involvement in Afghanistan, because we won't be able to control what happens when U.S. troops have gone. And I think it will become clearer and clearer that no matter what forces the U.S. keeps there, it will not be able to prop up an unpopular, corrupt Afghan government. And as Richard said, it's not that we want the Taliban to take over. They are an incredibly regressive force. But it is just an example of how the Taliban are local people. They are not going anywhere. And they've said they will not stop fighting until U.S. forces have left. Now, they're not going to count, oh, it's just U.S. troops and it's only these other contractors. No, they're going to consider them foreign forces, and they won't stop fighting until the foreign forces have left.
You have this report by The Times, Richard Becker, that says the U.S. will maintain that maintains actually a constellation of air bases in the Persian Gulf region, as well as in Jordan and a major air headquarters in Qatar, which would provide a launching pad for long-range bombers or armed drone missions into Afghanistan. This sounds like a broader plan, which means that the U.S. would attack Afghanistan whenever it wants, because based on the number of mercenaries, special forces, and intelligence operatives that are going to remain there, they're going to go after when they deem it necessary to kill either al-Qaeda elements or you have Daesh there, or if it goes after the Taliban. So is this part of the bigger picture?
Yeah, undoubtedly. I mean, we know a tiny percentage of what really goes on and how the war is conducted inside of Afghanistan. It's much more hidden than it used to be. One of the Pentagon's lessons of Vietnam was don't let people know what you're doing. So, you know, starting particularly with the Iraq War, but even earlier with the wars in Central America, very, very little was released by the military about what they were actually doing. And the same thing, I think, goes here. So the forces that are going to remain in the country, apparently the mercenary forces, the contractors, as well as the how close to Afghanistan are all these U.S., many, many, many U.S. military bases. I wanted to add one other thing that I think is important to consider, and that is right now the U.S.'s number one enemy that it's targeting is China. Afghanistan has a border with China, a small border. Afghanistan has a huge border with Iran, another target of U.S. aggression. And so that has to fit into this whole picture. And, you know, the surrounding of China is taking place mostly in the eastern and southern areas of joining China, but the aim really is to, in the pivot to Asia, is to surround China, and the preparations for war against China are going forward.
So is that what's happening, Media Benjamin, based on what Richard Becker said there? Do you agree?
Yes, there's been an effort since the time of Obama to get the troops out of these, quote, endless wars and move towards China. And we certainly see that during the Biden administration. There's talk about getting troops out of Iraq as well. The problem is they keep getting bogged down because they don't want to leave in failure. I think the Iran nuclear deal is an important piece of this. If the Biden administration can do its job in lifting the sanctions against Iran and getting back into the deal, that can help to ease the tensions both in Afghanistan and in the Middle East. And that's something that we in the U.S. have to push this administration to fulfill its promises that it made on the Iran nuclear deal and its promises that it made in over a year of talks with the Taliban to withdraw the U.S. presence.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much. We do appreciate it. Amin Alami was a correspondent who spoke to us at the top of the hour. Also, Media Benjamin there, co-founder of Code Pink from Washington, D.C. And thank you, Richard Becker, from the Answer Coalition from San Francisco. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitath, my entire team in the capital of Tehran. It's goodbye. Until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Allah. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, my first and foremost advice to you is to fear Allah. Be His obedient servant. Keep His thought always fresh in your mind. Be attached to and carefully guard the principles Islam which connect you with Him. Can any other connection be stronger, more durable, and more lasting than this? To command greater respect and consideration, or to replace it. Accept good exhortations and refresh your mind with them. Adopt piety and kill your inordinate desires with its help. Build your character with the help of true faith in religion and Allah. Subjugate your nature with the vision of death. Make it see the mortality of life and of all that it holds dear. Force it to realize the actuality of misfortunes and adversities, the changes of circumstances and times, and compel it to study the lives of past people. Persuade it to see the ruined cities, the dilapidated palaces, decaying signs and relics of fallen empires of past nations. Then, meditate over the activities of those people, what they have all done when they were alive and were in power, what they achieved, from where they started their careers, where, when, and how they were brought to an end, where they are now, and what they actually gained out of life, and what was their contributions to the human welfare.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Now, dear friends, one of the amazing lessons which we learn from the truly universal persona of Imam Ali is regarding fasting and how fasting is truly a divine act which merits a divine reward. In the historical texts, we find that at one point, someone had come to visit Imam Ali alayhi salam and had seen him eating sour yogurt in a small bowl and some dry, hard barley bread. When Imam Ali alayhi salam offered food to the person in return said that he was fasting. Imam Ali then replies and says, I heard the Messenger of Allah saying,